ॐ सहना भवतु सहनौ पुनत्तु सह वीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावतीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः उपाय पूर्वमेवोक्तः तच्चिन्तनाकथनादिकः तच्चिन्ताकथनादिकः एतदेकपरत्वेऽपि निर्बन्धो ध्यानबन्नहि उपायः पूर्वम् एव उक्तः तत् चिन्ता कथना आदिकः एतत् एक परत्वे अपि निर्बन्धः ध्यानवत् नहि. Remember, we're in the middle of a discussion here on viparita bhavana and how to remove the viparita bhavana. Viparita bhavana means that erroneous conclusion about myself, about the atma, the self being the body, identification of the atma with the upadis, body, mind, sense organs, and also this giving satyatva, giving reality to the world, missing the jagan mitya, the mityatva of the world, the apparent nature of the world, right? Missing the satyatva of myself, the reality of myself, myself being the substance and the being of this creation. Missing that, and missing the freedom of my being, taking my being to be limited by the body, mind, sense organs. So the viparita bhavana, these erroneous conclusions, are these two, right? Taking the deha to the body to be the atma, and taking the world to be real. So we'll see more what that means. But this is how Vidyaranya has been dealing with this viparita bhavana. These are two aspects of it. Now, the question has come up, which we're working on now. Does this viparita bhavana, in order to remove it, the removing it really requires, if you just for the moment, look back to verse 106. He gave a definition of really what really needs to be done in terms of gaining this jnana nishtha. One was tachintanam. It means your mind should be engaged. You should be thinking about it. Tatkatanam. You should be talking with each other, sharing in satsang, you know, in community, sharing with each other, talking about this knowledge, about your understanding. And then anyonya prabodhanam. Teaching each other. You know, in fact, with these three things, when we were going to the course, when I was at the course in India, we used to do all of these things. We used to meet with each other. We used to be teaching back and forth to each other, a lot of discussion. Why would you kind of plan it that way? Because that's so much of what is required. The engagement of the mind is required. So here, Vidyaranya says this, thinking about it, talking about it, sharing, explaining it to each other, and then contemplating upon it. All of these things are what we call Brahma Abhyasa. Brahma Abhyasa. Brahma Abhyasa translates very improperly as the practice of Brahman. So let's practice Brahman. But the Abhyasa, what it means is bringing yourself completely again and again, repeated bringing yourself again and again to that understanding of the nature of Brahman. That's called Brahma Abhyasa. Okay. So now, the question has come. We went through Shravana, Manana, and now the Nididhyasana. Nididhyasana has been viewed as really one of the means for removing this viparita bhavana. But what exactly do we mean by Nididhyasana? So let's kind of broaden the abhyasa in terms of viparita bhavana. The question has come up from the last few verses. In the practice of removing this viparita bhavana, these erroneous conclusions, do I have to practice japa, mantra japa, you know, the repetition of a mantra? Or do I have to practice concentrating the same type of what we call murti jhanam? When I do murti jhanam, I would be bringing my mind to really focus on a form, type of upasana. Or if I'm doing japa, there's a very particular way to do that. Now, in terms of this Brahma Abhyasa, is there a particular way to do that? A way that I'm enjoying, there's a vidhi. Is there a way that that has to be done? Because in fact, for the mantra japa, and for contemplating on a deity, there is a drishta pola. In other words, punya and papa are involved. It has to be done in a particular way. And so the ways to do that properly are taught to you, and then you should follow that, especially in terms of pronunciation and this type of thing. Or even in meditating upon a deity, if it's a particular dhyanam, a particular meditation, then there's a way that that's supposed to be done. And if you don't do it, you'll accrue papa. So in trying to remove the meditation and contemplation that's involved with nididhyasana and removing this viparita bhavana, does it have the same set of rules involved? And now Vidyaranya said, no, it doesn't. It's more like eating, you know. Because just like if you're to eat a meal, that eating, you are hungry. And so you want to assuage your hunger. And so you will eat a meal. There's countless different ways. There's countless different meals that you will eat and countless different ways that you can go about eating the meal and assuaging your hunger. Now, the difference is that, like, for instance, an example like eating, the result of eating is what we call a drishta pala, not a drishta. In other words, you get an immediate result from it, and it has to do with this vyavaharika reality. There's many, many ways to assuage your hunger. And like that, there are many, many different ways to assuage, to resolve this viparita bhavana. And the resolution of the viparita bhavana, these erroneous conclusions, is immediate and in the here and now. It's not that you're accruing punya and papa for doing particular mantras or meditations that have been revealed by the Vedas, and where the Vedas will say you have to do this in a particular way in order to accrue punya. Now, it's important that you follow this regimen in doing it, or you could accrue papa. You could accrue anartas, you know, the things that are very, very negative. So here, is that the case? This is the question that Vidyaranya has brought up. No, it's not the case at all. We're talking about drishtapala. And so it's a matter of learning all of the different ways to deal with your mind and deal with the different types of projections and projections that you're suffering from. Viparita bhavana causes suffering. If it's not causing suffering, it's not a problem, we don't notice it. It's the viparita bhavana, these erroneous conclusions that are causing us suffering. And so when we are suffering, then we should look at what is the cause of the suffering. So there's going to be a viparita bhavana involved there, right, if you're suffering. So what is the cause of that? And then what is the, how to bring my mind back? So that's the idea here. And so he says in this verse, so we had gone through a lot of these verses about this. So now he says, the upayaha, upaya means the means. Purvam eva uptaha. The means has been told before. This is the verse 106. The upaya for the removing the viparita bhavana, these erroneous conclusions, that we've already told that. Tachinta katanadikam. Now he's just quoting from that verse 106. Thinking about it, talking about it, contemplating on it, teaching it. Those are the means that are necessary for removing this viparita bhavana. Then he says, etad ekapadatvaipi. Even when you are meditating upon it single-pointedly, right? That's another one in this verse 106. Drawing your mind, focusing your mind single-pointedly on that. Even that, You know, so the katana, the chintana, the thinking about it, the talking about it, the teaching each other, all of those, and even meditating, doing dhyanam, meditating, nididhyasana, doing the nididhyasana upon that, even that one, nirbandha dhyanavat nahi. Even that one, they don't have the same restrictions, nirbandha. They don't have the same restrictions as dhyanam. Dhyanavat, like meditation on a form or doing japa. Same restrictions aren't there. So, nirbandha dhyanavat, the restrictions, dhyanavat, like dhyanam, nahi, definitely not there. Okay? So now, we're going to talk about this for a while and we'll say more about it. But he's going to talk about it, so I want to move on a little bit. Murti pratyaya santatyam murti pratyaya santatyam anyanantaritandhyah jnanantatrati nirbandhah jnanantatrati nirbandhah manasaschanchalatmanah murti pratyaya santatyam anya anantaritam dhiyaha jnanam tatra ati nirbandha manasaha chanchalatmanaha. He talks, gives the definition now of jnanam, of meditation. Murti pratyaya santatyam. Santatya means having a flow. So, murti pratyaya santatyam, a flow of pratyaya. Pratyaya means vritti. A flow of vritti. Say if we're doing jhanam on a murti, on an image of the Lord. We would have, in meditation, in jhanam, we would have a santatyam, means a flow of vrittis, a flow of thoughts that are just focused on that deity. It's kind of like in a film. If we use the example of a film strip, if you see a person in a film just standing there still, right? Actually, there are hundreds of film clips, right? Frames going in to allow for that image to just remain still. That means that santatyam is there. Right? The vritti remains the same, clip, 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 because the mind is always moving. But now the focus of the mind is held, vritti, 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 but on the same thing. And so when that takes place, the murti becomes something that is a living three-dimensional image in your mind. Just like if you're watching a film. Off of the santatyam, sometimes Swami uses the example of if you have one pot of oil, because this is something that they use in the rituals. If you have a pot of oil and you pour the oil into another pot, right? That oil will have a flow, right? The viscosity will hold it together. Right? Even though the oil is nothing but drops, still there's just a flow, like a line of oil going, holding itself together. So that's the santatyam. So when you do jhanam on a form, there's murti. Murti means the form, pratyaya santatyam, that flow of vritti, flow of thought modifications on that one murti, says. Then he says, though, not only that, there can be anantaritam means there can't be anything coming in between. Anya means another. There can't be any other type of vritti coming in between, or it'll break it. Right? So you're having a flow. Like, say, for instance, say in the movie strip, you have somebody standing there, and all of a sudden, another strip comes in, you know, with another bunch of frames. That picture's going to go. So it's the same. If you're meditating on something, you need to hold that. That requires you can't have other thoughts coming in. So being able to hold that image is what we call jhanam here. And then he says, there, he says, when that's the case, when we're doing that type of jhanam, then Ati nirbandha manasaha. There are all kinds of restrictions, right? Because you have to hold the mind in place. You can't just let the mind go, right? You have to, nirbandha means you have to control. You have to contain the mind. So when that's the case, when you're doing that type of jhanam, either in japa, where you have to always bring the mind back to the mantra, or on a murti, you're really having to hold the mind tightly, right? Why? Because, he says, very simply, manasaha chanchalatmanaha. The nature of the mind is chanchala. It is always moving. Manasaha, for the mind, the nature of the mind is that it always moves, it always changes. And so now, if it is natural for the mind to be chanchala, always moving about, always changing, vritti after vritti after vritti, then to try to get it to direct it onto one thing, you need to control it, right? You really see that? It's just the nature. There's nothing nothing wrong here. It's just that isn't how your mind is. Your mind will go from this to that, just auto-suggestion or associative thinking. You know, one thought will bring the next, will bring the next, will bring the next. And so that's how the mind operates in the world. Even with all of the vrittis, if I look here, I have a vritti, if I look here, I have a vritti, if I look here, I have a vritti. So you can have billions of vrittis going on, you know, day in and day out, all changing. So that's the nature of the mind. If you want to focus that mind on one given thing, you need to control it, right? Because it's not going to just do that for you, because that's not its nature. So here, do we need that type of control? In Nididhyasana, right, in this Brahma Abhyasa, to remove the Viparita Bhavana, that which is causing me to behave in a way that is not true to my knowledge, right? I'm behaving in a way that's erroneous, actually, that is it's a mistake in a way that isn't true to what I know. So do I need this type of control of the mind, you know, in order to do this Brahma Abhyasa? This is what he's talking about here. So, let's go to the next verse. Now what he's going does is he's quoting a verse from the Bhagavad Gita where Arjuna is talking to the Lord, to Krishna, about the nature of the mind as being something that is just in continual agitation. Okay. Here's Arjuna's verse to the Lord. It says, Chanchalam hi mana Krishna, Chanchalam hi mana Krishna, Pramati palavadridham, Pramati palavadridham, Tasyaham nigraham manye, Tasyaham nigraham manye, Vayori vasudushkaram, Vayori vasudushkaram. Chanchalam hi manaha Krishna, Pramati balavad dridham, tasya aham nigraham manye, vayoho eva sudushkaram. So Arjuna says to Krishna, he says, chanchalam hi manaha Krishna. Hey Krishna, you know, the mind is chanchalam. It is just moving all the time. Not only that, it's chanchalam, it's also pramati. Pramati means that it's very turbulent. So Arjuna is talking about his own mind. My mind is chanchalam. It's always moving. It's pramati. It's very turbulent. It produces agitation. It causes pain. And not only that, it's balavat. It's so strong. It's stronger than me. Right? It's balavat. It's very strong. It's very turbulent. And not only that, it's dridham. Dridham means what's a good word for that? It's adamant about what it wants. Dridham means it's very firm in its dridha. We could talk about that for nishta. I want dridha jnanam. I want my jnanam, my knowledge to be dridha, very firm. But now Arjuna is using the same word for the mind. My mind is dridha. It's always moving, it's turbulent. It's very strong and it knows what it wants. It has a mind of its own. It's stronger than me. Okay, that's what basically what he's saying. Then he says, Tasya aham nigraham manye. I think, he says, manye. I think that the nigraha, the control, tasya, of that, aham manye, I think that the nigraha, this control, tasya, of that mind, is sudushkaram, is very, very difficult. Very difficult to do. The su means very, dushkaram, very hard to do. Kara means doing, dushkaram. It's so hard to do. Sudushkara, it's just very difficult to do. How is it difficult? It's like trying to control the wind. Vayoho eva. This mind is very difficult to control. It's very difficult to control the mind. Like it's difficult to control the wind. Right? The wind, you can't grab the wind. You can try, but the wind will just blow right through your hand. The same, you try to control your mind. Can you grab a thought? Right? As soon as you go to control it, that thought's gone. The next one is coming. Right? So how to do it? I find this so Arjuna is talking to Krishna, I find this, you know, next to impossible, controlling the mind. It's like controlling the wind. And my mind is just continually turbulent and moving and strong-willed. So, Vidyaranya decided to throw this verse in from Arjuna just to make us acknowledge the nature of the mind and what it means to think about controlling it. What do you mean? What do you really mean when you're thinking about controlling it? Are you thinking that you should really stop the mind from thinking? That you should be able to do this santyam, santatyam, you know, this have just one flow of vritti that just is going into one object. If you're going to do that, you have to be doing it. See what I mean? If you're going to do that, you have to be doing it. You have to be concentrated on that. Because the minute you stop doing it, the mind will just revert back to its good old self, to its own nature, thinking and moving about and, you know, engaging in various activities that are of interest to it. That's another really interesting thing. We'll get to this a little later, but just to throw it in now. The mind goes toward what it loves. It thinks about what it loves. Now, you could say, well, a lot of times my mind isn't thinking about what it loves. No, it's thinking about what it hates. Okay. But it's thinking about what it hates because why does it hate that? Because that thing is getting in the way of what you love. Right? And so in any case, whether you're thinking of positively or negatively, you're thinking about what is meaningful to you. If something is an obstacle to that, of course you'll be obsessing on it. Right? You're obsessing on it because it's stopping you from having what you want. And so what you're really thinking about is what you want. That's just the negative form of it. That's very interesting to get to know your mind in that way, because when your mind is upset about something, or hurt about something, angry about something, and despairing about something, you know, you'll be often concentrating, you can often be concentrating on the despair or upon the anger, or upon who's caused the anger, you know, it just goes on and on and builds up a big web for you. But if you were to stop and say, you know, what is it that I love that is being threatened at this moment? What is it that is important to me that is being threatened? And then to start getting in touch with what the real problem is. You know? And then once you start going back to what is actually the thing that you're concerned about, which is the thing that you love, then you can, you've kind of untangled some of the problem, then you can really bring in Vedanta and bring in the nature of yourself and the nature of Ananda, and actually what often you can see is what is more important to you than that object that you love, like, or that thing that you love. Like, for instance, I'll get into this a little bit later in more detail, but like, for instance, I love you, but even more than my love for you, I love my shanti. I love the ability for my mind to be at peace. Right? I love my peace. And so I love you, but I want my mind to be at peace in spite of my love for you. Right? Because if I just love you, then the problem is that your behavior, you know, could cause problems for me. So if I love you means I need you to be in a particular way, right? Then if you're not behaving in that way, then you become a source of pain because I love you, right? But so you have to understand what kind of love this is, really. Mm-hmm. You know, I love your soothing nature. I love you when you're behaving in a way that makes me have shanti, that makes my mind feel whole and complete. I love you because you're able to do that for me. When you're not able to do that for me, though, that's very disappointing because I'm attached to you, the one who can do that for me. And I depend upon you for doing that for me. Okay, so that's samsara. Own little version of samsara. It's hellish. But what we want to be able to do, right, is enjoy the shanti and love you also. And from that shanti, have a certain independence there. And so once you start getting down to what it is that you actually love, then you can see how that object of love doesn't need to be a person. It can be, you know, usually is a person, but it can be so other things also. Your career and your money and so many, your security, so many types of things. You look at what it is that you actually love, and then you say, what do I really love more than that? And it will eventually work its way around to your knowledge. Right? It'll bring you back to your knowledge. Because what you really love is your freedom from pain. That's what we really love, I think. We really I can put it a positive way. What we really love is love itself. You know? It's not the object, it's the love. And so, I love the love. And so another way of saying that is I love the shanti. I love the well-being. I love the freedom of that well-being. And so I want to be able to abide in that freedom. And abiding in that freedom, love you, love Ishwara. See what I mean? So this type of thing, it's working your way. It's bringing your mind back. Now, this is all part of this chanchalam. The mind, this is where I started on this, the mind always goes toward what it cares about, what it loves in a given moment, you know. It's going toward what will give it the shanti, what it will give that, what it will give the peace. And so it's always engaged. It's doing this and doing that and doing this and doing that. It's not going to be sitting still. Right? And you don't need it to sit still. It'd be a terrible thing if you think, okay, to be a jnani, I have to come up with a mind that doesn't work anymore. Yeah. I have to kill the beast. I have to kill the mind. We don't have to kill the mind. Right? We have to allow the mind to be. But then, if some of its thinking, its way of thinking is producing pain, then that's where the type of analysis or working with that mind comes in. And that does not necessarily at all mean stopping the mind from thinking and doing jhana or even doing nididhyasana. It has to do with understanding. Okay, so anyway, right now, we'll get into that more later, but right now Vidyaranya is bringing in another verse now just to show how truly impossible the control of the mind is. He's now going to quote it's a verse from just a minute. Okay, where this verse is from.
Yoga Vaishishta?
Yeah. Vasishta. Yeah, Yoga Vaishishta. So Apyabdi Panan Mahataha Sumerun Mulanad Nadapi, Sumerun Mula Nadapi, Apivanyashanat Sadho, Vishamas Chitta Nigraha, Vishamas Chitta Nigraha. This Abdipanat Mahataha, Sumeru Unmulanat Api, api vanni ashanat sadho vishamaha chitta nigraha. He says the last part, hey sadhu, oh sadhu, oh good person, you know. Sadhu means a good person. So hey sadhu. So we're not going to say oh good person. So I'll say hey sadhu, you know. Vishamaha chitta nigraha. The control of the mind is vishamaha. It is very hard. That's a rocky road. Vishamaha means very uneven, rocky, unsteady, very difficult. Vishamaha chitta nigraha. The control of the mind is difficult. And now he's using some ablatives here, so it's going to be, is even more difficult than, because of the use of these ablatives. So let's see what he says. More difficult than what? Api, even more difficult than appipanat, drinking the ocean. It's more difficult than drinking the ocean. It's more difficult than what? Mahataha sumeru unmulanat api. It's even more difficult than unmulana, means even an uprooting Mount Meru, the great Mount Meru, which is a huge Himalaya, huge, huge mountain. Mount Meru is the mountain that the Lord Shiva lives on. Huge mountain. So even say you wanted to uproot Mount Meru, the great, giant, huge Mount Meru, controlling the mind is more difficult than that. Api vani ashanat. It's even more difficult than drinking fire. Vani means fire. Ashanat, than eating, not drinking, eating fire. It's even more difficult than eating fire. That's how difficult this chitta nigraha is. Oh, sadhu. So, forget it. Don't think like this. Don't think of the mind. This is so important for Vedanta also, for just because we've brought too many things over, too many misunderstandings over. It's as though we think that we have to control the mind. Control the mind means stop the mind, or just make the mind, even to say, make the mind do what I want it to do. You know, if you can define, Swamiji's defined chitta nigraha as that, control the mind, make it do what I want to do. That's like saying, make the universe do what I want it to do. Please, all of you, do what I want you to do. Yeah. Just think of it. The mind, just through the use of your sense organs, is taking in hundreds of thousands of vrittis every day. It's all coming in, all kinds of impressions coming in, you know. And they're all going to be coming out. There's in and out, in and out, in and out. Say you decide that you want your mind just to be in a particular way. That's not going to be realistic. It's like saying you want the universe to be in a particular way. The universe is as the universe is. As Ishvara is. Your mind is as your mind is. You can know how to be with that mind. That's different. Because of your knowledge, you know how to be with that mind. You can have shama. You can let those thoughts go. But you can't say you have shama. Right? Shama is an attitude toward your mind. That means this thought comes and I have the freedom to let the thought go. Right? So there's some nigraha there. You know? But to say, I don't want that thought to come, you try it. Swamiji tells us so many stories about this. Like if I were to, there's so many stories like the bald man, you know, the bald king that wanted to grow his hair, and he offered a huge reward, you know, to anybody that would give him some elixir or something that would allow him to grow his hair. And if he would get this, then he would give his beautiful daughter to whoever in payment, to whoever could bring this elixir. And if you can't, if you bring it and it doesn't work, then of course I will kill you. Okay, so he had to be pretty sure. So only one guy came. And he brought the elixir and gave all the instructions to the king how to put this on. He had to do it for 30 days and had to put it on just perfectly. And at the end, he told him everything. And he said, you know, and at the end, and now I'm leaving, I've told you everything, just make sure, there's one other thing, don't think of eggplants or potatoes when you're putting it on. That will negate it. That will negate the effectiveness of the elixir. So don't think of eggplants or potatoes. And the king said, fine. So every time he went to put it on, he said, don't think of the eggplants. Okay, there's the eggplant. Impossible to do. And so say you try to do that. Say you try to tell your mind what it can think, what it can't think. It's not going to work. You know? What it can feel, what it can't feel. Oh. But you can, like being a good parent, you can know how to be with the thoughts that come up. That's where the freedom is. You know, like we've used the example of, say, for instance, you have a certain, as you gain knowledge, you have an objectivity over your mind. You see that they are thoughts that are coming and going. There's thought flow. They're objects. Just like this creation. This creation, these are objects. Feelings are objects. They're known to me. They're experiences. Right? Feelings are experiences. Thoughts are experiences. Perceptions are experiences. We don't have to identify with those experiences, and we don't have to take them to ourselves, you know. Or we can. We have a choice. But we don't have to. But that itself is a huge, huge understanding. It's a huge freedom. Swamiji uses the example, if you go through, say you're taking a nice drive through the countryside, and it's so beautiful, and the scent, the fragrance of all of the flowers, and sunny out, and the green hillside with the beautiful trees, and you're just so much enjoying this drive through the country until you round the bend and you come upon a big garbage dump where the land has been raped and there's just garbage, piles of garbage everywhere, and all of a sudden the beautiful scents of the flowers have been replaced by the smell and the stench of the garbage. And so now you're driving through the garbage, and it's not that you particularly enjoy the garbage, but you don't have a feeling that I've become the garbage, right? Just like when you're driving through the beautiful scenery, you don't feel I've become the beautiful scenery. Now you go through the garbage, now I've become the garbage. We have more objectivity than that. It's not that we wouldn't prefer the beautiful scenery over the garbage, but I have a distance on both, and I can handle both. If I don't like the garbage, you know, I can know, well, I'll be out of that in a few minutes. Or I can turn around and leave, or I can do something, but I don't take myself to be it. We need that type of freedom toward the chanchalat one, this changing mind, which is going to be throwing all kinds of things up at us. Some things from the unconscious, some things just from the environment that are maybe not so pleasing, some reactions that my mind may have. There's all kinds of things. Like the Swamiji said, the mind does all, my mind can do all kinds of funny things. My mind can be very funny. It can do all kinds of funny things. So? He doesn't have to engage with the funny things. So we're like that too. We don't have to engage with the funny things. But that's different than saying they shouldn't be there. If you say they shouldn't be there, then you're getting into some real trouble, you know? Like forbidding it. That's the nigraha. I forbid you to think this, you know? Or if you think in this way, then you are not a good person. Right? All of this type of thing, all of these type of devices that we use to try to control the mind, to change the mind, often they're very, very ineffective. And the problem is that they're asking the mind to maybe do something that's not natural to it. Right? And so knowledge comes with the way you are with the mind. And in fact, that way of being with the mind does relax the mind. And so the stress and tension and pain that lack of relaxation was created does go away. It does go away, but it goes away because of the way you are toward the mind. See what I mean? It's because you're allowing the mind to be as it is, and then you're dealing with that mind from a position of wisdom rather than from a position of reaction. And that allows the mind to relax. So now he's given two verses that really talk about, and they're trying to really drive home this idea of the nature of the mind so that you don't get caught into trying to make your mind be something that it isn't, but rather try to be with the mind in a way that is helpful. See the difference? And it's huge. It makes all the difference in terms of your own peace. So let's go to the next one. Katana dhyana nirbandha. Katana dhyana nirbandha. Shrinkala bhadda dehavat. Shrinkala bhadda dehavat. Kim twanante tiha sadhyaihi. Kim twanante tiha sadhyaihi. Vinodo natya vadhyaha. Vinodo natya vadhyaha. Katana adau. Na nirbandha. Shrinkala bhadda dehavat. Kintu ananta itihasa adyaihi dinodaha natyavad diyaha. So now the question can come, well, yeah, but if I'm not trying to control the mind, if I don't have to control the mind, then what do I do? What do I do with my time? How do I give the mind an environment, provide the mind with an environment that allows for this type of maturity to take place? It's the idea. So it says, in katana, adhyan, katana, etc., means in talking about it, thinking about it, sharing it with others, and even contemplating upon it. Na nirbandha. There isn't any bondage there. There's no restriction there. He gives an example. There's no restriction like what? He goes, shrinkala buddha dehava. Like the body, which is buddha, which is bound by shrinkala, iron fetters. Just imagine the body is all bound up in iron fetters. There's no bondage like that. You're not trying to bind yourself, right? When you're doing this Brahma Vyasa, in talking about it, just think about it. If we're in a conversation, we're having a conversation, we're talking, we're guru bhais, and we're thinking about the class. We're talking about some point that came into the class, we're discussing it. Or you're in satsang, you're asking a question, the teacher is answering it. Or you're doing manana, you're thinking about it. There's no bondage there. In fact, it's something enjoyable. And he gives an example. He says, when you're doing this thinking and talking about it and sharing this knowledge, it's enjoyable. He says, it's not like being bound, the body being bound in fetters. He says, rather, ananta itihasa jahi vinodaha. All of it, it's a happy thing. He says, it's enjoyable for the mind, just like natya. Bharatanatyam means dancing. In India, if you go to the Bharatanatyam and you watch the dance, if in Bharatanatyam, the dance, it's always going to be about some of stories in the Puranas or some stories in Ramayana or Mahabharata. Always be some story about the Lord or the God or Goddess going through a dance and telling the story through dance. That is something that is very beautiful and engaging in the mind. For the mind. Also in the itihasas, this is what they say, ananta itihasas. There are hundreds and hundreds, limitless itihasas in stories, like the Ramayana, the Mahabharata, all of the fables, all of the different stories that are there. All of those are something, you know, engaging your mind in these types of thoughts. All of these things are very, very enjoyable. You don't feel like your mind is being restricted or shackled. Your mind is enjoying contemplating on these things. He's using, as we'll see in the next verse, he's using these itihasas. Because in India, if you were to study like the Ramayana or the Mahabharata or some of the Puranic stories, you know, all of them always lead to this knowledge. They're always resolved in antakarna shuddhi, attitudes of mind that give shanti. And there'll always be the teaching will come in and take you to the understanding of the mityatva of the world, the freedom, the unnatural ananda of yourself. So in reading these stories or contemplating on these stories or just doing manana on the text, All of it is very enjoyable and very engaging. You don't have any feeling of the mind being constricted or pressured. Like if you're doing dhyanam or japa, there is a constriction of the mind. You are doing an action. You are engaging in a particular action that requires the stricture on the mind. But here, for Brahma Vyasa, there is no such restriction. You know, it's that we keep our mind in an environment where we are predisposed to bringing our mind back to our understanding, but there's no restriction in that. Do you see where it's kind of going here? Mm-hmm. Let's do the next verse. We'll talk about it a little bit more. Chirevatma jagan nitya, chirevatma jagan nitya, ityatra paryavasanatah. Ityatra paryavasanatah nididhyasana vikshepah nididhyasana vikshepah netihasadhibhirbhavet. Do you have that paryavasanatah there or paryavasakritah? Either one is fine. Chit eva atma jagan mitya iti atra parayavasanatah nididhyasana vikshepah na itihasadibhi bhavet. The last quarter, he says, there nididhyasana vikshepah, there is no interruption to nididhyasana, vikshepa, means throwing you off, distraction, to your contemplation. There is no distraction, nebhavet, by the itihasas, by all of the stories, all of the puranas, all of the different fables that you read. They don't cause any distraction at all to your nididhyasana. Nididhyasana means bringing the mind back to recognition of the truth. That's nididhyasana, seeing. The studying of these Ramayana, Mahabharata, all of these, they don't cause any distraction toward that contemplation. Why? He says, paryavasanataha, because they all resolve, all of these itihasas, they all resolve themselves where? To chireva atma, that the atma, that yourself, is pure consciousness, is consciousness alone. And jagan mitya. So all of these stories, all of the dance, all of the things that are culturally held, all of them resolve themselves into the Mahavakya. That the Atma, that your Atma, that yourself is pure consciousness, and that that consciousness is the very truth, the satyam of this mitya jagat. That this being, which is the being that you are, it's not this body, mind, sense organs. It itself is this body, mind, sense organs, in fact, this is where we have the Dehatma Buddhi. The Atma is taken to be the Upadhi. I take myself to be this. Where actually the Atma, your being, is just pure consciousness. Such it. And this body, mind, sense organs belongs to Ishwara. Right? It's part and parcel of the whole creation. And this whole creation has for its being myself. That's the Chireva Atma. My being is consciousness alone. This entire creation is mitya. If you say that entire creation is mitya, what it means, dependent reality, mitya requires satyam. You can't have mitya without satyam. Right? Like if I say, if I have a clay pot, if I say the clay pot is mitya, well, that means it's a dependent reality. What is it satyam for the clay pot? Is the clay. Right? The clay is the reality. The pot depends on it totally. You can't have there's no such thing as mitya that doesn't have satyam. So mitya, what is the truth of the mitya? Is the chidatma. That this consciousness, which is not contained or one with this body, mind, sense organs, I can say my being is the self of the body, mind, sense organs and the entire creation. I am the satyam of this creation. But my chit, the conscious being that I am, is not in any way changed, limited, or modified by this body, mind, sense organs, my being is completely free. And so that Chireva Atma and Jagan Mitya, the truth of my being as pure consciousness, and this creation being totally dependent on it for its being, Jagan Mitya, all of the itihasas, all of the natya, bhartanatya, all of these things only resolve there. Right? So that's why, you know, it's so enjoyable. Really, I love reading the Mahabharata and the Ramayana or listening to Swamiji's storytelling on this, because all of the stories have as their backbone this knowledge. And so the stories are always going to resolve there, always resolve there. And so that is a great, it sets a great example for your mind. Just like if you're with your teacher, that, you know, if your teacher has nishtha, there's a certain beauty about, and the teacher's behavior. You know, like Swamiji's always been a role model for me that way. Because I always learn from the way he handles the situations, the way he handles himself, the way he handles situations. And he's had many, many very difficult situations. And so I don't wish those on him. But I always learn. I always learn from that situation, how he handles those situations. Well, when you're reading the Mahabharata or the Ramayana or some of these books that are based in the Vedanta, then you understand how they handle these situations. You know, how they handle their own mind, how they handle negative emotions. In these texts, they don't create a situation, or they don't have heroes and heroines. And another nice thing is they do have both heroes and heroines, not just heroes. You know, so both are there. There's the feminine and the masculine there. But they don't make those heroes and heroines unreal. Like Rama and Sita and Lakshmana, and they all have the whole gamut of emotions. Then they're put through all of the different situations that life could offer. So it's not about not having the feelings, not having the difficult situations. It's how to be in them, how to follow Dharma. You know, how to handle all of that. That's why it's so, so valuable. And then it'll always come around to knowledge. So Dharma and knowledge. How to be a human being. You know, how to be a human being in the world in a dharmic way that is an embodiment of this knowledge will resolve. So these things become so soothing to read, because they set up exemplars for how to be. That's why it's such a very rich tradition that way. So he says, all of these itihasas, etc., because there's so many different things available, these don't restrict them. They don't restrict you in any way. They're not about restriction. They are enjoyable, in fact. And so the way that you are with your knowledge, the way you are work with yourself, is not something restrictive. It's something that doesn't require the mind not to be itself, you know, that allows you to be with the mind in such a way that it can relax. Another thing important here, the cause for pain, not physical pain can be your prarabdha or whatever scrape you've got yourself into, you know, but emotional pain especially, you know, and pain that's caused by your situation. That pain has to do with really my attitude toward the situation. And that my knowledge, if my attitude toward the situation, the way I'm relating to the situation, is causing me pain, then I want to bring my mind back, you know, in the light of this knowledge, and see what it is about the situation or about that mind that's actually producing the pain. Because it's going to come down to the way that I'm relating to the situation or the way that I'm relating to the mind. And so because of that's the viparita bhavana is causing the pain. As I gain jnana nishtha, the things that cause pain to my mind become less and less and less, because less and less am I asking the body, the mind, and the world to be different, to be other than what it actually is. Like if I'm if I'm asking the world to be responsible for my ananda, it really is happenstance whether or not it can delude me into thinking that it's doing that. Because the fact is that the ananda that I experience in the mind has nothing at all to do with the world. The ananda, the source of the ananda, is only the Atma. And that Atma is never removed from you at any time. But what causes the wholeness of the self, that well-being, to is that come and go, is that we get sidetracked by our relationship to objects that cause the mind to experience tension and relaxation. Tension, relaxation. When the mind is relaxed because things in the world are going my way, that mind itself experiences happiness or pleasure or all the positive emotions. When the mind is tense because things are not going the way that I think they should, then the mind experiences and produces the negative gamut of emotions. For Jnani, all the while, the wholeness of my being is illumining those positive and negative experiences in the mind. Now what I'm saying is that as you gain nishta in your knowledge, become more rooted in your knowledge, the mind stops depending upon the world to produce happiness for me, because that's not really happening in the first place. So the mind depends upon the ananda, the self itself. It, reveling in the self, it then experiences Ishwara. Right? This is what Ishwara is. This is what the world is. The source of the ananda, always, whether I'm deluded to thinking it's taking place out here or not, it is always only my own being. And so I don't require the world or another person to be in a particular way in order for me to be whole and complete. But if I do require you to be in a particular way, then when you're not being in that way, which will be probably 50% of the time, when you're not being in that particular way, my mind will produce pain by its tension. Okay? That's what's producing the pain. The person themselves doesn't have the ananda to give. The ananda is already the very swarupa, the satyam, which the whole creation enjoys. Right? But it's the quiet mind that will reflect that ananda in variety of ways that we call pleasure and happiness and joy and bliss and all of these things, depending upon the vritti in the mind. You have to make a distinction. The recognizing yourself, which is the stable wholeness that is always there, it's not waxing or waning ever. And then when the mind is relaxed, that wholeness will of yourself reflects in the mind in a variety of positive ways. When the mind is tense, it reflects, the reflection is as though blunted, and so the mind is behaving in a way that seems inimical to my nature because of its tension, and therefore I want to get rid of it. The relaxed mind that's enjoying some glimpses of little leshas or little specks of ananda because of its relaxation is more harmonious to my own nature. So I want to get rid of it. It's like they use the example. If in a clear lake, if the sun is reflecting in a very clear, quiet lake, the sun will reflect, The shape of the sun, the brilliance of the sun will clearly reflect there. But if the lake is muddy, if it's muddy and agitated, the sun will be having a nature in reflection in the lake that's not true to the sun. So when your mind is agitated, and you take yourself to be your mind which is producing pain, right, by that state of agitation, that's not comfortable. And if I take myself to be that, then I'm not comfortable. So one viveka is, first of all, to be able to differentiate the conscious being that you are that's illumining that agitation. And that one is not agitated. That one is whole and complete. So I need to be able to do that, to be able to differentiate my own presence from that agitated mind. The sun is not the agitated reflection, right? And the conscious being is the sun, not the reflection. So like that, my being is always the same. I'm illumining my mind. And I never change at all. That's me. I need to differentiate that. But then I have to recognize also, even differentiated, I prefer my mind to be quiet, not to be painful. What causes it? That's what I love, is my mind to feel all is well with me. So why doesn't it sometimes? That's the viparita bhavana. That's the viparita bhavana. It's because I've spent lifetimes, beginningless lifetimes, of taking you to be responsible for me, my happiness. This situation to be responsible for my happiness. That's a huge responsibility I'm laying upon the world and upon all everybody I know. Behave this way, I'll be happy. Don't behave that way, I won't be happy. If you don't make me happy, then I don't like you. If you make me happy, I like you. It goes on and on and on and on. We get the whole web, you know. So this is what we need to get out of. We need to get out of it because it's painful. So how to do it is to pull your mind back and own up your knowledge, and then you can let Ishwara be. You can appreciate the person as the person is, you know, because your wholeness isn't at stake. You can appreciate the situation as the situation is and start kind of enjoying the complexities of Ishwara. We can enjoy the complexities of Ishwara if we feel whole. I can enjoy you if I feel whole. Right? You experience this so many times. You can be in a very difficult situation, but you happen to be feeling good. When you're feeling good about yourself and you're feeling whole, the situation can be terrible, but you're fine. Right? Or you can be in a great situation, just the opposite, and be feeling terrible. Right? Even though the situation is fine and you know everybody's fine, everything's good. But you feel terrible, right? Because something else is bothering you. So it's being able to pull myself back to, by the strength of my knowledge, you know, and not in a mean way. That's another thing. Not in a mean way. And that's where it's, I think, so helpful to bring in, for those of us who have a teacher or who have been taught by somebody who is benign. You know, that meanness isn't there. If you've had a parent that is benign, not mean, that meanness isn't there. And so the way that you treat your mind and pull your mind back and help it to learn, to remember, lifetimes, beginningless lifetimes of being involved in samsara. And now the mind is wriggling its way out. And so it just needs, it needs you as a jnani, it needs your knowledge, you know, to help it, to pull it back, to help it. And that's what gives the nishta. That is, in fact, and we think that is the nididhyasana. We think of nididhyasana usually just as meditation when I contemplate upon my being. But every time you bring your mind back to the recognition of the truth of yourself and the mittattva of the world, that is nididhyasana, because at that time you have seen it. And so you have to kind of broaden your understanding of nididhyasana to be something that's taking place all the time throughout the day. But in every given situation, you know, especially when you get yourself into trouble, you know, you pull yourself back. Later, in a couple of verses from now, Vidyaranya will say, you know, it's really not a self-forgetfulness, say you're involved in something. Self-forgetfulness is not really a problem because you're engaged in something, you're not thinking about yourself, you don't have to walk around thinking about yourself all the time. That's not going to be a problem because as soon as you bring your mind back, there you are. It's not anything. The problem is this viparita bhavana, the erroneous conclusion. That the self-forgetfulness, what we call, well, I'll get into this idea of self-forgetfulness, it's a little misnomer a little bit, but self-forgetfulness is nothing. It's the erroneous conclusion that can come out of it. That's what causes the pain. And that's where the nididhyasana, bringing my knowledge to that situation, is what we need to do. If we don't do it, then we're stuck in the viparita bhavana, stuck in the pain. Okay, let's stop there. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om. Yeah.
In those verses, they use Vikshepa in a way that seemed different from the way I heard that.
Yeah, because you're using it in Avarna Vikshepa.
Yeah.
But the Vikshepa can also just mean distraction or agitation.
Mm.
Yeah. When we say Avarna Vikshepa, then we use the word projection.
Mm.
But it means the Maya has, you know, agitated.
Mm.
But we use it as projection.
Mm.
Yeah.
What do you mean by being mean about the mind, bringing the mind back? What do you mean by being mean?
Like being critical. Critical toward the mind. Like say the mind goes out and gets lost in samsara, then you say, you stupid idiot, you don't have any knowledge. you know, there can be, people can talk harshly to themselves. You know that
yeah.
inner voice?
Sure.
The inner critic?
Yeah.
I'm saying that inner critic, that... it's not useful, you know. It's like that's not a good way to learn or to teach anybody. But if you teach through communication and through understanding and through trying to help, so that's all I meant. I was just kind of tying it up to the inner critic. What did you think?
What I was thinking is, I think of the nuns, for instance. They beat me in order to learn, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure it didn't help you at all.
No, but I also do it to myself.
Exactly, and
yeah.
that's where learning, that's why it's so important to listen to how you talk to yourself and then be able to bring in, talk to that person and say, you know, talk to that person who's talking so critically and say, tell that person, that part of you, you don't have to, we don't have to be that way anymore. That's how the nuns talk to me. You know, you don't have to play that role anymore. And so that you can kind of help those critical, because those critical voices, that they're really like young children who are playing the part of a negative parental figure of some sort. Like those nuns, your psyche would, as a child, would just interject that type of way of talking to yourself. That's part of the superego in a way. Same, a very critical parent, you'll interject that, and that's how your mind will talk to yourself. You won't even notice it because it'll be going on from childhood. And so once you become aware, oh, look at how I'm talking to myself the way I would never talk to another human being. I couldn't even imagine talking to a person that way, and look at how I'm talking to myself. And so then you can talk to yourself and say, you know, this is, you're talking to yourself like this. You're feeling that you need to be, that this is the right way to be, is critical. So you're doing a job, but now I want to change your role. You don't have to do that job anymore. From now on, I'll take care of you. And then you start being kind. I'm your friend, I'll be kind. You tell that part of the mind. I care about you. I want to help you. I think you're good. You have to respond to these parts of the mind that can be so very hurtful, and you're unconscious of it. So I was just making a jump there because we've talked about a lot of this inner dialogue before.
Mm-hmm. Oh, go
ahead. Finish, and then I'll go to
yeah,
try.
And then the other thing is like about the use of a mantra or focus or a concentration.
There's nothing wrong with that at all. It's just he was using, there's particular mantras that are done in a very particular way, the chant. Like even if we do Purnamadah, these all have swaras. They have to be done properly. And there are different meditations that have to be done properly. He was only bringing in the example, is Nididhyasana like that? Is there a particular way that this has to be done, or I'll be accruing anarthas, things that are very negative?
And then the other confusion I have is that, you know, I got 2 mantras from Swamiji, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel so guilty if I don't do them every day, you know? Where there's times, you know, when I rather contemplate the self.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. That can
be an mind. And then I feel I have to come back to that again, because otherwise it's like, yeah, it's just it's a lot of guilt behind it. I'm not doing the mantra because I asked him and he gave it to me.
But the mantra is something like can be something that you carry with you as a friend, you know, not a something that has to be done all the time.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, it's a friend that you have with you all the time. You know, but that you can get into those type of situations. I used to have that, like when I would chant Rudram, and then of course then I learned not only Rudram, I learned Sri Suktam, then I learned Medha Suktam, then I learned Durga Suktam, you know? And now, and plus some other chants that are important to me, now we're up to like 20 minutes of chanting, you know? And so I got into, as I was adding these on, and I would do them every day, then it got to be, I don't want to do this, this is too long. And then I started worrying about it.
Well, that's why you're supposed to get up at 3 in the morning.
Yeah. But you can become obsessive on it. So in one way, chanting is very beautiful. And it's a nice routine to have. Like I do chant and I like to chant. But you can also kind of become obsessive. You know? Mm-hmm. And so then some days when you feel more like just being prayerful or in your meditative time, or just doing nididhyasana, or just being with yourself, you feel like you can't do that because all the deities will feel badly,
exactly.
You know, be mad at you.
And not only that, to help me at one time, so I'm not even being loyal to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's, for the Rudram, for instance, there's one mantra, Om Namah Shivaya, which comes in the middle of the Rudra. That Om Namah Shivaya, chanting that is like chanting the whole Rudra. Then there's, because everybody has this problem. So even the Vedas, they have this problem. So if you can't chant the whole Rudra, chant Om Namah Shivaya. They say this, I'm not saying this, this is what they say in the Vedas. Namaste astu Bhagavan Vishveshwaraya Mahadevaya Trayambakaya Tripuram Dakaya Trikalagni Kalaya Kalagni Rudraya Neelakantaya Mrityunjayaya Sarveshwaraya Sadashivaya Shriman Mahadevaya Namaha. See, I couldn't break it in half because then I would feel bad about that. But that is also chanting. That is like chanting the whole Rudra. If you can't chant like that, then you should chant Om Namah Shivaya, which comes in the middle of the Rudra. It's the most sacred mantra. So they say these type of things so that when you can't do all of your routine, then you have something that you can say which stands in the place of that routine. See what I mean? If your mind can't let go of it. Do you understand what I mean? Like if I can't do Rudra, I can say Om Namah Shivaya. You don't even have to do any of that. I'm just saying that because the mind can get into that habit. You know?
It also can be the mean mind, right?
Yeah.
That makes you do that.
Yeah. But also, it is important. You don't have to do all of these chants. It's not necessary. But they're also efficacious. They're also beautiful to do if you want to do them, you know? Or to even have one chant, or to do a mantra. But even in the Bhagavad Gita, in this chapter 3 and 4 especially, the Lord himself, Krishna himself says, you know, you, as a human being, you need to recognize Ishvara. There needs to be a gratitude to Ishvara. You know, because Ishvara is the one that's given you this body and mind and gives you the reins and gives you the foods and gives you your life. And if you just take it all, without being and having any prayerful attitude, you're being like a thief. Do you remember when we did those verses? There's 3 or 4 verses like that. It's like being a thief, you know? And so he's just trying to bring about that attitude of recognition of Ishvara. That's all for Antagarna Shuddhi.
Where did that come up? In the Gita?
Chapter 3 of the Gita. We've already done those verses. But. I don't know if I'm helping you.
What about this this moment-to-moment contemplation? I mean, is that meaning bringing your mind back all the time to the recognition of yourself? I thought knowing yourself, that recognition is the self.
You don't have to bring your mind back at all.
Mm-mm.
If it's abiding,
mm-hmm.
you know, true to your knowledge. We're talking about when it's not.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
So
like I could say that when you're not doing Nitta Dhyasana, you know, when you're at peace and there's nothing contradicting your knowledge, then that's just the reality that you're experiencing. Is yourself and this creation as Ishwara. That's just it. You don't have to say, oh, I'm experiencing this as Ishwara and I'm experiencing this. It's just what it is. You know? But what about when your mind gets pulled out into samsara? Right? Then you bring it back. You can say, well, why should I have to bring it back? You don't have to. You can suffer. But say you say why wouldn't you bring it back? You know, especially if you know how to bring it back, why wouldn't you do that? The only reason you don't do something like that is because you're not taught that you're supposed to do that. You know, as though, you know, you gain knowledge, like in the Gita later on. They say, imagine use the example of a bonfire. Say if you build a huge bonfire. Huge big bonfire on the beach, and then it's time to light it. You light it, that bonfire, in just one little corner. Right? And then if it's windy, it'll blow it out right away. So you have to protect it and light it and fan it and all of that until the fire takes. And once the fire takes, then the wind and all of the circumstances will just ignite it more. Right? But initially you have to help it. That's the situation here. When you have your knowledge, you see it clearly, you're gaining more and more and more clarity, but, you know, you haven't had it for a long time. And so that knowledge has to be protected, you know, until it protects you. You protect it until it protects you. You know, and it will protect you when it's become strong enough. But until that time, you protect it. And what's one of the ways you protect? What does that mean? Well, when your mind's running, you keep in satsang. There's different ways of protecting it. You have satsang. You keep doing shravana, you know. You keep yourself in an environment. You did shravana and manana, nitta dhyasana, and so that you have satsang, you know. So that and then you do this chintana kathana, you know, that's thinking about it and talking about it and sharing it with other people and contemplating on it. You do all of that. Until all of that drops off. It drops off because it's just your reality. You don't even think about it. Right? And so when your mind is running out because it doesn't have that strength, the buddhi doesn't have that strength yet, then what do? You help it. You bring it back.
Yeah, but there also seems to be, you know, like the sense of me, it seems to be just constant. And even when it runs out or stays at home, that's kind of a contemplation.
That is constant. And it's
kind of a contemplation also. I mean,
that's right.
Noticing that.
That's a beautiful contemplation. That yourself is not running out or changing or doing anything, no matter what your mind is doing. That's jnana.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm.
But when your mind is out there causing itself pain, you know, then it's just sensible to bring it back. Because it's gotten lost. It's like a child gets lost. You go and find your child and, you know, bring her home. You bring him home. So your mind's gotten lost out there. It's drowning. That's the image they use in the Shastra, is drowning.
Grab the damn rope.
So, you know, you have to go and rescue it. Yeah.
What's been hardest for me recently is this sense of this gulf between my ananda and these sort of painful thoughts. And what you said is that sense that, oh, this is inimical to my nature, and that desire to withdraw on the ability. I feel like I have to go, oh, no, that's not me. But then finding there's something troubling in that to me, like there are things that need attention. And so finding the right attitude and when and how much of myself to give to certain things that are arising versus sort of pulling back and just disengaging has been difficult for me.
Yeah. It depends on what it is. Like, say if something is pulling your mind out and causing you pain over and over and over again, it's something, then you have to spend some time figuring out what that's about and what it is that you really need from that situation, what it is that you really want, and what is it that's actually causing the pain. So there's a lot of psychology that can come into kind of understanding what's pulling it out like that.
And I'm just thinking also just about how to understand the proper attitude. I mean, sometimes I think, well, these things are all meaningful, this is all valuable, this is all part of the order, and so there's something that requires some transformation, attention, and in order for that transformation to take place, I have to stay with these different emotions that arise, versus
what?
Versus another inclination that I often have, which is to kind of negate the reality of that.
Oh, I see.
Draw myself.
You know, I think having both are useful because you want to stay with it to be able to kind of understand it and transform it. And you also, at the same time, want to be able to objectify it, to let it go. So the one doesn't negate the other. Mm-hmm. But if you only use one, say all you're doing is letting it go, and you're never dealing with it, then chances are that thing is coming back again and again. On the other hand, if it's such that you can actually let it go, it's not grabbing you very much, because usually we don't have that freedom. If something's big and has grabbed me, I can't just say, withdraw from it and let it go, right? Because I'm grabbed by it. And those ones I really do have to work on. If it's something that you can just let pass and be totally free inside, then it doesn't have much hold on you.
Yeah, it seems tricky though, because there is, while the mind can't be totally controlled, over time there are practices that enable you to kind of to have a certain kind of control over the way the mind works, to dissolve, so to speak, certain ways of thinking, and to see that as a pattern. But then after a while, I think, well, I'm kind of dissolving everything, or dissolving all these things that I decide are interfering with my sense of my peace of mind. So
what you're saying,
that line, or when to, I'm looking for like some rule to determine this is when to be available and how to be available, and this is when to disengage.
Maybe you're talking kind of about emotional bypass. You know, so... excuse me. There are some blurry lines. You know, it's not always cut and dried. But one thing I've kind of noticed is that the creation creates situations for you that you can't just get away from. You know, and if it makes it so that you can't escape, and that means you have to deal, especially if you're mumukshu. It seems like Bhagavan picks on the mumukshus, that's probably not true. You have to, it creates a situation, you can't just run away. You can't just dismiss the person. You can't dismiss the situation. And when that's the case, then you really have to be in it and work it out. You can't pretend like it doesn't exist. And so those are the real learning situations. If it's a situation, there's other kinds of situations like, say you're in a situation, the person's very, very, very difficult and creating a lot of turmoil for you over and over again. And the situation comes where you don't really have to communicate with that person. It's not necessary. Then if That's an out. Bhagavan's given you an out. You don't have to be in that situation. But if when you leave that situation, you don't feel clean about it, you feel like you've run away, then you haven't done all of your business. You know, because the reason that you've left the situation is because you can't deal with that person. You see what I mean? Then I know that Swamiji, because I've tried to do that before in my past, he said, no, you have to stay until that situation is resolved. And so I took him to heart for that. I learned that a long time ago, actually. I just know that if I'm in a difficult situation, that is not the time to leave it. I can leave that situation, but you don't make anything black and white. I'm just in general. If you're in that difficult situation, then I will eventually get out of that situation, but not till I've resolved the situation. And then I feel I haven't run away from the situation. And I've stuck it out. And then that way you gain strength. I don't know if these things are hitting what you're talking about or not. But do be careful. It's complex. It's complex. It's not everything. It's not just black and white. And a lot of it, you have to look at your own feelings. Like,
I mean, one of the things that comes up for me is like, what is my swabhava in terms of like four types? And holding myself accountable for these ways of being, of types that are not like true to my nature, and wondering in this kind of culture how not to abandon what is true to my nature in an effort to, I don't know, conform to these ways that I see all about me, and the confusion around that, oh, I ought to be doing this, and another part of me says, that's not my nature to participate in the world in that way. So that seems also like a factor in my question.
One thing is that you might overthink the situation. And we tend to overthink sometimes. Instead of just being with the situation as it is. You know? I don't know if that's useful for you, but you can look at it sometimes. And we think too much about things. Really, I'm serious.
That was kind of what my question was going to be about. But I said to somebody, oh, I just got to get my head around it, meaning I have to think in terms of Vedanta. I want to get that kind of thinking around the situation. She said, why don't you change the word head for heart? And, you know, I was trying to be polite and said, well, yeah, you know, That's a nice substitute, and I mean, I felt good about myself being able to say that, but I was thinking, yeah, and somewhere I've heard in some text the buddhi, the home of the buddhi is the heart.
Mm-hmm.
But you could also say the intellect is in the head. Yeah, I wanted to differentiate that because there's so many negative associations with the intellect in the Western world, and I'm trying to sort that out.
I don't really separate heart and head.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that in India, we think even hridaya and hrit means heart, is used for buddhi.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't make a distinction between that the intellect is something divorced of our feelings.
Yeah, my understanding is that it is in the heart. The buddhi, which we call the intellect, is in the heart. It's the mind of the teaching is in the heart.
Yeah, but what are you getting at?
Yeah, I just want to see if that's correct. Okay, then could you say that the manas would be in the brain? I mean, just in terms of location?
I don't think of it like that. I don't think of it in terms of location. The manas is a type of thinking, right?
Right. But it's not based in the heart, right? Manas type of thinking. It's based in confusion, isn't it?
Yeah, more, but you're dealing with all of this in a way that I guess I don't usually think about. That's why I'm not just jumping in. I don't think about the manas being lodged in the brain, mm-hmm. the buddhi being lodged in the heart. Mm-hmm. I don't think like that about it, to make that type of differentiation.
Mm-hmm. It's just a way that the...
What if you said the whole antakarana is lodged in the heart?
Mm.
Instead of saying one's up here, one's down here.
Are you saying that would be useful?
I'm just trying to talk your language a little bit.
Mm. Yeah, maybe just throw the whole thing out. Just that association with the heart is nice, but it's not black and white, huh? Not useful to think in those black and white terms.
Yeah. I guess. What does the heart mean to you?
Well, it used to mean emotion, but now it means buddhi.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, maybe emotions that are like the clean water in the bucket, you know, whatever that phrase is. Those emotions that reflect... peace and happiness are I don't know how to differentiate emotions.
Yeah, I think it's better just to kind of leave it,
mm-hmm.
personally.
Yeah.
Or ask Swamiji, because I don't think those two are coming together in a really nice way.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Yeah. The heart, the physical heart, is used as a sthanam for meditation, just like the third eye.
Mm-hmm.
Above the head. These are sthanas, placements, you know, and sometimes if you're doing a meditation, you can place your buddhi, your mind, in this sthanam, right here, a little bit to the right, I think, of the heart, right here. So. And it's just, then you watch in your mind, you watch where the thoughts are rising from. You place your mind there and watch where the thoughts are rising from, you know, and so sometimes that's, you use the physical heart as a location to place the mind. Sometimes if we do a guided meditation, we can say, place your energy, place the mind, the buddhi right here in the third eye, or place it above your head here also we can do. You know, but it gives a sthanam, you know, a place that is conducive for a certain amount of type of absorption. But you don't have to take it as a real...
Because I've spent so much time with these meditations that I think I get fixated on it and then spread it all over where it doesn't belong.
Yeah. And so say that the buddhi is used for the hridaya, the heart, the buddhi.
Mm-hmm.
But the buddhi is the deeper mind that mm-hmm. is not the chattering mind. The manas is the more chattering mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so in meditation, but still the antakarana, right? So in meditation, we'll try to calm that chattering mind through japa or through doing numbers, 5 plus 4 plus 6 minus 10. That gets rid of the manas, the chattering mind, and gives the deeper mind, which is just the buddhi, the decisive mind, the jnana mudra, the ahankara is. You know, we're just the reflection of consciousness, the chittabhasa. Right? But pervasive to the whole mind is the self. You know, so you want that antakarana to quieten down, to be more the type of thought in the mind, to be more the buddhi, rather than the chitta, the memory, all kinds of thoughts going on, or the manas, just the fluctuating mind, the emotions and all of that. You bring that all into quietude, and then just the buddhi is there. You know? And then that buddhi is just like a clear window, or clear mirror, reflecting the Atma. You know? And so then we can resolve that mind into that buddhi, into the self.
Did you just say the ahankara? Because the buddhi is where the ahankara is?
Uh-huh. Buddhi and ahankara belongs to the buddhi.
Oh, okay.
Right? You don't have to make that distinction. You can keep
uh-huh.
them separate.
Uh-huh.
But the ahankara is also decisive, and it's also that ahankara, that
uh-huh.
thought, has for its basis, it's alambanam. We had that word in approach on abhuti. It says for its alambanam, the atma.
Mm.
Like when you say I am, what that what is the self that it's referring to is Brahman. You say I am, that ahankara. Its basis for that is the self. Right? And so that ahankara will still be there with the buddhi. The manas is gone, the ahankara is still there. That ahankara then can be resolved into the self. You see? So then the ahankara gets, you know, the chinmudra. The ahankara gets identified with the self rather than with the upadis. Yeah, it's very nice. Done?
That's good. Can I just ask one quick question?